On Thursday night, 15th of September, she assigned Raymond Deary, the former chief judge of the federal court based in Brooklyn, New York, to serve on the role. She also declined to lift her earlier order, citing ongoing disputes about the nature of the documents that she said merited a neutral review by an outside arbiter. The court does not find it appropriate to accept the government's conclusions on three important and disputed issues without further review by a neutral third party in an expedited and orderly fashion, she wrote. The Justice Department on Friday night, 16th of September, told the appeals court that Judge Eileen Cannon's injunction unduly interferes with the criminal investigation, prohibiting investigators from accessing the seized records to evaluate whether charges are appropriate. It also prevents the FBI from using the seized records in its criminal investigation to determine which documents, if any, were disclosed and to whom, the department said. Though Judge Eileen Cannon has said investigators are free to do other investigative work that did not involve a review of the documents, the department said on Friday that was largely impractical. Nothing the discovery of dozens of empty folders at Mar-a-Lago marked classified, it said the judge's hold appeared to bar it from further reviewing the records to discern any patterns in the eyes of records that were retained, which could lead to identification of other records still missing. The Department of Justice also asked the appeals court to reject Judge Eileen Cannon's order that it provide the newly appointed special master with the classified documents, suggesting there was no reason for the arbiter to review highly sensitive records that did not involve questions of legal privilege. CNBC has also covered the same story and gives us more details. Lawyers for former President Donald Trump on Monday urged a federal judge to reject an effort by the Department of Justice to resume its review of documents seized from Donald Trump's home, while the agency appeals the judge's decision to appoint a special master in the case. Judge Eileen Cannon's order authorizing the appointment of the special master, an independent third party, to examine the seized records for personal items and possibly privileged material is a sensible preliminary step towards restoring order from chaos, Donald Trump's lawyers wrote. The government should therefore not be permitted to skip the process and proceed straight to the preordained conclusion, they argued in the U.S. District Court in Southern Florida. The FBI seized thousands of government records when it raided Mar-a-Lago, Trump's resort home in Palm Beach, Florida, on Monday, 8th of August. Many of those documents bore classification markings, including dozens of folders that were empty when they were collected by the FBI. The Justice Department has argued that a special master is unnecessary because a team of agency officials has already completed a review of the documents to exclude material from prosecutors protected by attorney-client privilege. The Department of Justice also argued the appointment of a special master could harm the government's national security interests in the criminal investigation. Judge Eileen Cannon, who was appointed by Donald Trump last week, ordered a special master to determine the records before turning them over to federal prosecutors. Her order also temporarily blocked the Department of Justice from further investigating the documents behind classification markings. The Department of Justice on Thursday appealed Judge Eileen Cannon's ruling to the U.S. Court of Appeals for the 11th Circuit, which holds appellate jurisdiction over cases from district courts in Florida. The same day, the government also asked Cannon to stay her order enjoining review of the classified marked documents while the appeal is proceeding. On Friday, Donald Trump and the Department of Justice each submitted two cases to serve as special master while expressing disagreements about the scope of the review of the seized records. The Department of Justice wants the special master to send any alleged executive privileged documents to the National Archives and Records Administration. While Donald Trump's attorneys say there is no need for the special master to do so.
The truth behind the occupation.
My name is Yehuda Shaul. I grew up in what you would call the political right in Israel. I was an infantry combat soldier and a commander. I finished my service as a company sergeant. My sisters are settlers. One of my brothers is a settler today. Even though I grew up in the political right, I found myself in a place where I couldn't justify anymore 90% of actions I took part in.
Yehuda Shaul is the co-founder of Breaking the Silence.
But after serving Israeli military forces as a combat soldier, he decided to do something that changed his life forever. He was the first Israeli soldier to tell the truth about the occupation of Palestine.
I really hope that I'll see the end of the occupation. The first real place I was deployed was Hebron. The second I arrived in Hebron, I started having doubts.
December 2016. The United Nations Security Council approves Resolution 2334. It reaffirms that Israeli settlements in Palestinian land are illegal and a violation of the international law. A few weeks later, with Donald Trump already in the White House, Israel announces the expansion of the West Bank settlements.
Between the United States and the State of Israel.
It means more settlers to add to the 600,000 that are now living in Palestinian land.
In the occupied territories in general, you basically have two communities, Palestinians and settlers. These two communities do not have the same rights. Palestinians are under military law, enforced by the army, and settlers are under Israeli civilian law, enforced by the Israeli police. So I arrived to Hebron, and my mission is to protect the settlers.
They come from all over the world, invited by Jewish organizations and travel agencies working for the settlers' cause.
I come from Los Angeles. I flew 15 hours yesterday to come show support for Israel.
Heavily guarded by Israeli soldiers, every tour of hate contributes to putting more pressure on Palestinians. On the days of the tours, Palestinians are with a gun at their heads, sieged inside their houses, while settlers explain to the tourists how they conquered the land. The first advice to the tourists is, keep away from the Palestinians or you will be killed. Settlers create hate tourism. The goal? Bring more settlers to set down in Palestinian land.
I'm 30 years old and I serve in a special unit called Dubdevan, specializing in counter-terror inside the West Bank, specifically. Now, what's special about my unit is that it does undercover operations.
For at least half an hour, four men had been throwing stones at Israeli soldiers. But in a matter of seconds, they pulled out their guns, opening fire at the group of protesters.
We have soldiers, fighters, that know how to assimilate within the Palestinian society. They speak Arab, they dress as Arab.
The four men are, in fact, Israeli soldiers disguised as Palestinian. They are known as Mustarabin, an Arabic term that literally means Arab pretenders, infiltrators among Palestinians to carry out military missions.
With that ability, we're able to specific missions from kidnapping or stopping all kind of terrorists or wanted to complicated and even classified operations.
They also carry out selective executions. It was 12th of November 2015. About two dozen men wearing bulky jackets barged into a Palestinian hospital, pushing what appeared to be a pregnant woman in a wheelchair. But they were not heading to the delivery ward. The people caught on the hospital were, in fact, undercover Israeli officers. About 10 minutes later, the Israelis were on their way out, leaving behind a Palestinian man dead and taking his cousin with them.
And I remember really clearly, they divide us to two groups, and we're standing one in front of another. And then they told us, you need to imagine that you're going into the field. They're a Palestinian, a terrorist. He's gonna shoot your mom, rape your sister, and he's gonna kill your little brother. And right before you go in, this is how you need to be in your mind.
I'll just give you one example, what we call in the IDF, making our presence felt. We start night shift patrol, 10 o'clock to 6 o'clock in the morning, 8-hour shift. We walk in the streets, bump into a house. It's a random house. The sergeant, the officer who leads the patrol, chooses these houses, wake up the family.
Now it's the middle of the night, around 3, 4 o'clock in the morning. We have our weapon. Our face is covered with colors, so we'd be intimidating.
Lock them in one room, separate men from women, search the place. You can yourself imagine the dynamics, what happens when a military unit bumps into your house 2 o'clock at night.
We knock on the door. The head of the family opens the door. The first time we realize this is a family we're going into.
Knock on some doors, make some noise, throw some shock grenades. Run to the other corner of the street, invade another random house. Wake up the next family.
Open all the doors, open all the lights, open all the windows. Wake up all your family and bring them here to the living room. We need to question you.
Search the place, you know, climb on the roof, jump from one roof to another, go down through the balcony, wake up the next house.
Really exciting on one point, because this is the first time you're out there. On the other hand, this is not exactly the war zone that I was looking for, or I was really anticipating for.
And that's basically how you pass here at Auschwitz. 24 hours a day, 7 days a week. From September 2000, when the second Intifada started, till today, it didn't stop for 1 second.
I remember one of the main operations that I've done. It was this big operation. We were all very proud of it. We decided we need to do a thing called a hot operation. Get into a house, we were blowing up the door with explosives. And the guy with the explosives put explosives on the door, and he put a little bit more. And we go and we hide in the corner, and 3, 2, 1, and huge boom went off. And I really remember it, and also seen it later on the camera. And right after the boom, we quickly go inside. Looks like the house was picking up in the air and thrown down. All the windows were broken. The doors were torn. And we quickly find the guy. We take him outside. We put him against the wall. And there's something really weird. The guy doesn't look like the guy that we're looking for. And the house doesn't exactly look like the house that was supposed to break in. Then we notice we blew up the wrong house. And we go out to the next corner, find the right house, and continue the mission.
Almost on a weekly basis, I would sit down with my soldiers and talk about values and morality. I remember one Thursday, you know, you just finish sitting down talking about values and then you start a patrol and you walk in the streets of the old city and suddenly we see a suspicious bag in the side of the road. Could be a bomb. Could be garbage. Both happened. What do we do? We grab the first random Palestinian and send him to pick it up. If it's a bomb, it would explode. If not, we continue. 2 hours ago, we spoke about the equality of human life and how every human being... And now we just proved that the life of a random Palestinian in the street is worth less than what? One bullet of an M16 that we can shoot it and check whether it's a bomb or not? 20 minutes waiting for a bomb, you know, engineer? What is obvious for me is that protecting Israel from terrorism is a very small part of what we do. What we mainly do in the occupied territories, it's about making sure Palestinians will never be free.
We are going back to Jerusalem al-Quds to meet a so-called NGO. They call themselves My Truth, and the organization was born in the social media.
Controversy is being stirred up in Israel involving one of the country's most polarizing activist groups.
They stand for the values of Zionism, and their goal, tell the truth about the occupation of Palestine. But their truth denies any violation of human rights, killings, or even the occupation. Their members are veterans of the Israeli military forces and were created to fight breaking the silence.
My name is Lior Shahat. I've served in the IDF. I'm also a part of an organization called My Truth.
My name is Ben. I served in the IDF. My Truth was open up in direct response to breaking the silence.
My name is Eitan Meir. I'm the International Relations Coordinator for Im Tirtzu. I was born and raised in New Jersey in the United States, and I immigrated to Israel in 2008. Im Tirtzu, it's a non-governmental organization, and its goals are simple, to promote and advance Zionist values in Israel.
Do you think breaking the silence are traitors?
Breaking the silence gets millions and millions of shekels, foreign governmental entities in Europe, Denmark, Holland, Spain, even Germany, France. I don't know what their ultimate goal is in breaking the silence and all these other organizations that receive funding from foreign European governments in order to defame and delegitimize the state of Israel. I look at their actions, and their actions are 100% anti-Israel.
How do you feel when the Minister of Defense say that you are traitors?
Moshe Ya'alon, the former Israeli Minister of Military Affairs, says openly that breaking the silence is an organization of traitors and that they were banned from all military events. Lieutenant General Moshe Ya'alon, Defense Minister of Israel, after all the controversy and war crimes committed under his orders during the last operation in Gaza, he says, "I can still look at myself in the mirror.
I can look to myself in the mirror."
About the cases open in several civil courts across the world, he has an explanation. The world is lying.
When the Minister of Defense calls you a traitor and a spy, people on the street respond to this incitement, and then our office gets physically attacked once, our activists get physically attacked twice on campuses. And right-wing bullies published the phone number of the grandparents of our executive director, and they've been getting calls in the middle of the night. Your granddaughter was in a car accident, she's dead, she's in the hospital. Yeah? It's becoming very filthy. What we've seen in the last few years is more and more attempts by the government to try to silence anyone who speaks out about the occupation.
This is the website of Breaking the Silence. Here you can find hundreds of testimonies of soldiers that served the occupation in Gaza and the West Bank. They tell about crimes committed against the Palestinians. Abuse. Assassinations. Bribery. Confirmation of killings. Deaths. Everything documented with place, date, and names.
Also, a lot of times they find that, you know, with breaking the silence, a lot of their stories are not true. And you have the commanders of these soldiers coming and saying, "Hey, I was there. That's not how it played out. What are you talking about?"
Breaking the silence, it felt bad for me to see how they act.
I was there. I served in the army. I was in very difficult situations in the Golani Brigade. And these things breaking the silence says did not happen. They either did not happen or exaggerated, and they certainly do not reflect the general doctrine of the IDF. So when you have Israelis going abroad and slandering the country, how could you expect the people of Europe to think otherwise?
My Truth is trying to fight against the rising support that Breaking the Silence is achieving around the world, among human rights organizations, but also governments.
There is a settler NGO financed by the Israeli government sending spies undercover into activist groups and human rights organizations to try to spread paranoia, and it's kind of like a Stasi-type behavior. They try to send us people who will give us false testimony so we will publish and lose our credibility. They send two guys undercover to our activist group, becoming friends with people, embraced by people, being brought into the homes of people while everything is recorded from hidden cameras. Sent a guy to give us state secrets about classified operations behind enemy lines in Syria so they can initiate a security investigation against us. Now, our researcher sits down with this guy, and during the interview, he insists 4 or 5 times to talk about Syria. And our researcher tells him, we're not interested in Syria. Let's move on, go back to the West Bank and Gaza. And right away, we sent this interview to the Israeli military censorship. And later on, we were able to confirm that the guy was a mole, was a spy for the settler organization. Then we release it to the media. You have a settler organization with Israeli government funding sending a soldier to breach national security laws to give us state secrets so they can initiate an investigation against us. It's the opposite of anything that makes sense. That's how far the Israeli political right has gone to try to silence anyone who speaks out against the occupation.
Breaking the silence, you have to realize this is the credible minority of it. And in those cases that they are found to do it, there are laws. And
they say because soldiers are afraid to join Breaking the Silence.
Anyone that's been to Israel, and I encourage all the viewers to do so, will realize that Israelis are the last people, I would say, have a problem about speaking their mind.
Do you think there are many soldiers desiring to speak out inside the IDF? They are afraid to.
Yeah, what we know is that the Israeli government is trying to do many different things to try to make sure that soldiers will not speak out. For example, they're now taking us to court to force us to expose the identity of soldiers who served in Gaza in 2014 and testify to us so they can throw them to prison.
Every day during that operation, between 1 to 3 in the afternoon, the IDF had something called a humanitarian ceasefire to allow the local population in Gaza to go out, get the food they need, visit, you know, their relatives, breathe some fresh air. When you go to an organization like Hamas, unfortunately, that was the time when they would shoot the most rockets. We decided not to do anything because we decided it was a ceasefire, and we just allowed them to keep firing rockets, putting, you know, Palestinians on top of the Israelis.
Gaza is the most heavily populated enclave on the globe. 1.8 million people, and more than 1 million are refugees that before 1948 lived in what is now the occupation. This strip of land is, in fact, a huge refugee camp, but also an open-air prison, sieged by Israel by land, sea, and air. Last Israeli aggression on Gaza lasted 50 days of intensive bombings. Entire neighborhoods were reduced to rubble. Operation Protective Edge, as it was called by Israel, continued for 7 weeks, leaving behind around 3,000 deaths and around 500,000 Gazans displaced. And if it continues, experts believe, Gaza will become a place where no humans can live.
I would say the findings that we have after interviewing today over 80, not over 90, soldiers and officers who served in Operation Protective Edge is that the massive amount of civilian casualties, over 1,000 civilians, over 500 children, the massive amount of destruction of infrastructure, of civilian infrastructure. Yeah, about 18,000 apartments destroyed. It's not a coincidence. It's a direct result of two new doctrines that the IDF has adopted that shaped the way this operation was conducted, led to this destruction that we left behind. One sentence of 4 words that every Israeli combat soldier grows on. Yesh safek, ein safek. When there is doubt, there is no doubt. If you're in a situation of doubt, You're not sure what the rules of engagement are. You don't see clear the target. The orders are to shoot to the knees and the bottom, and you're afraid you're going to hit the stomach. You have no doubt you don't pull the trigger. Because once you pull the trigger, there's no way back. In Gaza, the same sentence was used? Exactly the opposite. There is doubt, there is no doubt. If you have doubt, if you're not sure, pull the trigger, because we prefer the mistakes to be at the expense of the other side.
You know, we don't have any red lines anymore for our security. Don't we stop somewhere and say, am I going to do this in the name of a security, really? You might say it's security, but I know that this is not my values.
The problem is the occupation. Any army in the world that will get the order to go and occupy another people forever will behave this way. And the only way you can do this is if you don't see Palestinians as equal human beings to you. Because to an equal human being to you, you just don't do this. That is immoral. And it's because the mission is immoral. Our behavior was immoral. The problem is the political mission the army is sent to carry out. Hence, the solution is ending the occupation, is changing the political mission the army is sent to carry out.
What you heard was an IRIB English radio program.
In the limelight.
Britain's cost of living crisis is worsening, with food price inflation at its highest level since the 2008 financial crisis. The sharp rise in prices is pushing up the average annual household bill as Britain's poor struggle to pay rising energy bills. Despite the relative decrease in the inflation index last month, for the month of August in England, statistics show that volume of retail sales decreased more than expected during this period, and this is a sign that England is moving towards economic recession. We are prepared for you a look at some of the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. The Reuters news agency writes, Britain's economy grew by less than expected in July, raising the risk that it is already in a recession, with the sharp climb in energy tariffs hurting demand for electricity and a leap in the cost of materials hitting the construction sector. Recent official data showed, with inflation at a 40-year high of more than 10%, gross domestic product, or GDP, expanded by 0.2% from June, weaker than a median forecast of 0.4%. In the 3 months to July, gross domestic product was flat compared with the previous three-month period. Some economists said recent data suggested the economy might be on course to shrink in the July-September period, having contracted by 0.1% in the April to June quarter. Jake Finney, an economist at PwC, said, "This would mean that Britain enters a technical recession for the first time since lockdown restrictions ended." Paul Dales at Capital Economics said, A disappointingly small rebound in real gross domestic product in July suggests that the economy has little momentum and is probably already in recession. In August, the Bank of England forecast a recession for the world's fifth biggest economy, lasting from end of 2022 until early 2024, due in large part to a hit to living standards from energy prices pushed up by the war in Ukraine. But recently, new UK Prime Minister Liz Truss announced a cap on domestic energy tariffs, which, along with an expected round of tax cuts, reduces the risk of such a protracted hit to Britain's economy, albeit at a cost of £100 billion, or $116 billion, or more to Britain's already stretched public finances. The Office for National Statistics, the ONS, said anecdotal evidence suggested that the surge in power prices was changing consumer behaviour and demand for energy had fallen. Separate trade figures also showed the impact of soaring prices, with the value of imports of fuel hitting an all-time high of £11 billion in the month of July, and representing a record 21% of all goods imported into Britain. The Financial Times also reports on the same story. Sterling slid to its lowest level since 1985 against the US dollar on Friday, 16th of September, after a round of weaker-than-expected data on UK retail sales amplified concerns that the country was headed for a prolonged recession. The pound dropped as much as 1% to 1.135 per dollar, the first time it has breached the 1.14 mark in almost four decades. It rose back to just above $1.14 in New York trading, but remains down almost 16% in 2022. The currency's sharp decline reflects a broad rally this year in the dollar, as well as particular concerns over Britain's economy. Sterling was off about 0.5% on Friday against the euro at 1.141 euros, leaving it down about 4% this year. According to data published on Friday, 16th of September, by the Office for National Statistics, retail sales fell sharply in August as British consumers struggled with soaring prices and high energy costs. The quantity of goods bought in the UK fell 1.6% between July and August, reversing a small expansion in the previous month. This was a larger drop than the 0.5% contraction forecast by economists polled by Reuters news agency, and the latest fall since July 2021, when COVID-19 restrictions on hospitality were lifted. Olivia Cross, economist at Capital Economics, said the figure suggested that the downward momentum is gathering speed and supported her view that the economy is already in recession. The Office of National Statistics said that rising prices and cost of living pressures were affecting sales volumes, which have continued the downward trend since the summer of 2021, following the reopening of the economy after pandemic lockdowns. The figures highlighted how high inflation has hit consumers and a wider economy. The government's £150 billion energy support package announced this month is expected to limit the blow from the recent surge in gas prices, but it did not dispel the risk of a recession. Victoria Scholar, head of the investment at Interactive Investors, said the fact that the sterling fell against both the US dollar and the euro on Friday showed that is not a dollar move, but in fact, it is traders selling the pound amid negative sentiment towards Britain's economic outlook and investment case. The website of Turkey's Anadolu news agency covers the same story but from a different angle. A think tank said in its report British households' spending power is expected to be slashed by an average of £3,000 by the end of the year as living standards drop by the largest margin in a century. The report prepared by the Resolution Foundation, an independent think tank focused on improving living standards for those on low to middle incomes, said that household incomes are expected to fall by 10% this year as well as in next year. This means real earnings would fall at the fastest rate since 1997 and that by mid-2023, real pay growth since 2003 would be erased. Together, the number of those in absolute poverty would increase by as much as 3 million. The Resolution Foundation said that these estimates already include the government's existing £30 billion package to support, announced in March. Inflation in Britain is now in the double digits, 10.1%, in its highest level in the past 40 years, driven mainly by surging energy prices. The think tank called for tens of billions of pounds of further government support. Lalitha Tri, a researcher at the Resolution Foundation, said that the future of British living standards looked terrifying. She said typical households are on course to see their real incomes fall by £3,000 over the next 2 years. The biggest squeeze is at least a century, while 3 million extra people could fall into the poverty trap. No responsible government could accept such an outlook, so radical policy action is required to address it. We're going to need an energy support package worth tens of billions of pounds, completed with increasing benefits next year for October's inflation rate. Lalitha Tri added, the new Prime Minister also needs to improve Britain's longer-term outlook, which can only be achieved by a new economic strategy that delivers higher productivity and strong growth.
The wildfires in Greece, Turkey, the United States.
Palestinian prisoners in Israeli jails continue to engage in hunger strikes.
Kim Yo-jong, the powerful sister of North Korean leader.
On the news line.
The conflict between Azerbaijan and Armenia after a truce has blown up again. About 100 soldiers have died in total. This is the worst fighting between the two since their 2020 war. According to Azerbaijan's president, Ilham Aliyev, provocations committed by Armenian forces at the border have been averted and all necessary objectives were fulfilled. It blamed Armenia for the flare-up. It is widely reported that this conflict is due to the dispute over Nagorno-Karabakh region, which two wars have been fought between the former Soviet republics of Armenia and Azerbaijan. A quick history check reveals how ethnic Armenian separatists in Nagorno-Karabakh first broke away from Azerbaijan when the Soviet Union collapsed in 1991. The war that broke out afterwards claimed the lives of around 30,000 people. Back in 2020, when another war broke out, which lasted 6 weeks, 6,500 lives were lost. The fighting ended with a Russian-brokered ceasefire. Moscow deployed thousands of peacekeepers in the region to successfully mediate to prevent the war from continuing. The question is, what is behind the most recent flare-up? Azerbaijan needs access to bodies of water in order to provide energy resources to the West, which, given its relationship with Iran, Israel and Western entities would prevent that from happening. Azerbaijan's last 2 years of military action against Armenia is to cut and separate the land route between Iran and Armenia and the direct access to Nakhchivan from the southern area of Siunak or Zangezur Corridor, a concept for a transport corridor which, if implemented, would give Azerbaijan unimpeded access to Nakhchivan. Meanwhile, Israel, the U.S., Russia, and Turkey do have a hand either directly or indirectly in this conflict, all for their own political objectives. Israel is a supporter of Azerbaijan, and as such has strengthened its relationship, especially when it comes to military equipment like drones. This to have a front against Iran. Meanwhile, Iran has always had a diplomatic approach to the conflict. During the past war, it was very telling what Iran said, that renewed fighting between its neighbors, Azerbaijan and Armenia, could escalate into a wider regional war. And this is where the U.S. may have motives behind seeing a renewed conflict. One intention may be to draw Russia into this war in order to weaken its capabilities in the Ukraine conflict. And the U.S. certainly does not mind if Iran's borders are destabilized, leaving that task to its watchdog in the region, namely Israel. The U.S., however, is presenting another side to this provocation. The U.S. Secretary of State Anthony Blinken has said that Russia may have a hand in this conflict, stirring the pot in order to distract from Russia's most recent losses in Ukraine, according to the U.S. point of view.
Iran's President Ebrahim Raisi and his high-ranking diplomatic and economic delegation has visited Uzbekistan on an official visit. The aim of the visit was to expand bilateral ties with Uzbekistan. Iran and Uzbekistan signed a total of 17 memoranda of understanding that the two countries would boost their cooperation in the fields of trade, cargo transit, cultural exchanges, health and custom issues, among others. Another important aim of President Raisi's trip was Iran's further integration into the Shanghai Cooperation Organization. Iran has held signing a memorandum of commitments to join the SCO. The announcement was made by Iran's Foreign Minister Hossein Amirabdollahian, who is accompanying the delegation on the visit to the city of Samarkand, which is hosting a summit of the SCO. It means that Tehran has now entered a new stage of diverse economic, commercial, transit, energy, and other cooperation with the member states of the regional body. The Shanghai Cooperation Organization was founded by China, Russia, Uzbekistan, Kazakhstan, Kyrgyzstan, and Tajikistan in 2001.
Whereas Shanghai Cooperation Organization is about exactly what it says. I mean, it's about countries cooperating in the sphere of economic issues, but also security. And I mean, if we look, what are the benefits for Iran? Well, I mean, there are a number of benefits within the sphere of economics and security. Hard security. Because, I mean, Iran has been subjected to decades now of economic coercion and threat of military action by a US unipolar world, which has been using its institutions to coerce and squeeze Iran.
It's currently the world's biggest regional market, with 8 official members and 3 observer states. Iran and the organization started a formal process for Tehran's accession to the bloc in March. Its membership was later approved by the Iranian administration. Despite the US-led efforts to isolate Iran over the past decades, Tehran's diplomatic weight in regional bodies is now growing. Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization will give it economic and political room to further integrate into the non-Western-led bloc.
This is a possibility for Iran to develop cooperation in such things as economic matters with other countries in the non-Western world. This is equally true for the large countries such as Russia or China, where such an arrangement, it's beneficial for everyone. It's a reciprocal exchange. It's not a one-way exchange. And so I think in this regard, Iran, with its location and with its resources, is a very useful addition.
Iran has also applied to join BRICS, a group consisting of Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa. This forum represents 40% of the world's population and 26% of the world's economy. Ultimately, BRICS could become a club of the world's largest energy producers and consumers outside the United States. Iran holds the world's second largest gas reserve, and its membership in BRICS would result in added value for both sides. Iran's potential membership to the BRICS group would be a severe blow to US attempts to isolate Iran. It's believed that Iran's presence in the Shanghai Cooperation Organization and its role in the BRICS Plus economic mechanism have both made Iran a partner in international macro decision making and in the political, security, and economic fields.
What happens here, it provides possibilities to create meaningful cooperative relationships with countries of the non-Western order. And this is the order that is rising. We can see lately too, Iran has not been the only one under pressure, but India as well for its independent position on Ukraine. So, these Western institutions are just absolutely part of their foreign policy agenda, which is to maintain US hegemony at all costs.
It will also elevate the position of the multilateralist front in the international calculations. Tehran for a long time has called for the pro-multilateralism front to establish and promote independent financial, economic, political, and cultural mechanisms in order to make a smooth transition from the current unilateral US-led world order to a multilateral one.
When it comes to Iran, Israel has never refrained from relaying its sentiment, especially when it comes to Iran's civilian nuclear program. It has always maintained that Iran is after weaponizing its nuclear program, and it has gone out of its way to provide the IAEA and the US with fabricated evidence to prove its false claim. But Israel may have stepped too far in its latest claim against Iran and the JCPOA sanctions removal talks. The head of Israel's spy agency, Mossad, said the revival of a nuclear deal with world powers will not give Iran immunity from Israeli operations. This is a fully loaded statement, which, if taken a look at closely, actually proves that Israel has executed destructive and lethal acts against Iran, including sabotaging its nuclear program, destroying Iran's nuclear facilities, and assassinating Iranian nuclear scientists, to name a few. David Bernier, in his first speech since becoming Mossad's chief, has said, "We won't take part in this charade. Even if a deal is signed, it will not provide immunity from Mossad operations." Even though Israel has never admitted to acting against Iran, this can be interpreted that the opposite is true. Iran's response to these statements were to the point. Iran's foreign ministry spokesman, Nasser Kanani, said, "We do not expect a terrorist regime anything other than terrorist actions." Some Israeli acts of terrorism against Iran include the assassination of four nuclear scientists and damaging Iran's nuclear facility in Karaj. Now, the question is, will the international community react to this, or will it wait until Israel commits another act of violence or terrorism against Iran?
Israel is a rogue nation. It is a terrorist nation. It will not adhere to international law. It will not respect international law. The fact that it has been working against Iran, assassinating scientists and other means against Iran, just indicates that it is a rogue nation. That if the JCPOA should be resurrected, Israel will not respect Iran's borders as it has not in the past. We have to remember that Israel has been has violated international law repeatedly, not only in Palestine, Iran, but Syria and Lebanon. Israel has no regard for international law, has no regard for human rights. So these statements by the Mossad chief are just consistent with Israel's criminal activities.
Talks between Iran and the world powers on its civilian nuclear program have progressed to the point where the impasse may have been resolved towards reaching a solution. That is one of the reasons Israel has reacted by publicly stating it would not stop from executing acts against Iran. And its moves in that regard have been in overdrive. On the surface, Israeli moves to undermine the deal appears to have worked. Israel announced that it does not believe that Iran and world powers will return to their nuclear deal before the November midterm elections. And even though it looked like a deal was on the horizon, the IAEA repeated its old accusations of wanting an explanation on traces of uranium. A quarterly report by the nuclear watchdog on Iran's compliance with the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action, JCPOA, accused Iran to have continued enrichment beyond limits in the agreement, even though Iran has demonstrated maximum transparency. But these negative reports on Iran may be political in nature. The U.S. administration and President Joe Biden may not want to jeopardize the chances for his party winning the midterm elections. Israel's Prime Minister Yair Lapid is also dealing with elections in Israel, and a deal may ruin his prospects. For now, the JCPOA survival talks has slipped back into the intensive care unit, and its chances for success appear dim.
Israel is certainly overstepping its bounds. It has no right to say that it's going to assault another nation, that it's going to ignore an agreement that, or it's going to violate an agreement that it isn't a party to, that it is trying to sabotage that agreement, which hasn't even been made yet. As I mentioned before, Israel is a rogue nation, doesn't respect international law. Now, the JCPOA signed a number of years ago between European nations, the United States, and Russia, and it was the United States that violated it. The Israeli government has been opposed to it from the start and continues to be opposed to it. We have to remember, Israel is a nuclear-armed nation. It and the United States have no right to say what other countries will or will not have nuclear weapons. Now, I personally believe that the fewer nuclear weapons there are in the world, the better it is. But if Iran is being threatened by two nuclear-armed countries, it must defend itself and defend its people. But Israel, to get back to your point, is certainly overstepping its bounds. It is certainly fomenting problems within the Middle East when there don't need to be these particular problems. But this is typical of the behaviors of a terrorist nation, and that is what Israel is. It does certainly threaten its own so-called security by threatening basically war against another powerful nation. So it is doing itself no favors, but to be protected by the United States in all things, so it continues with its crimes and its threatened crimes throughout the Middle East.
Head of Hamas Political Bureau, Ismail Haniyeh, has visited the Russian capital, Moscow, to hold political talks. During his trip, he had meetings with several high-level Russian officials, including Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement has stated that Haniyeh was also accompanied by a high-ranking Hamas delegation during his Russia visit, including Deputy Hamas Chief Saleh Arouri and members of the Hamas Political Bureau. The Palestinian Islamic Resistance Movement also visited Russia in May 2022, where it appealed to Moscow for support in confronting Israel. So far, Russia has been vocal about its support for Palestine, and this was indicated in Haniyeh's Moscow visit 2 years ago, where he praised Moscow for defending the rights of Palestinians, and also dismissed a pro-Israel proposal, namely former U.S. President Donald Trump's self-proclaimed so-called deal of the century. But there has been something different about the talks held between Hamas and Russia this year. The two sides had their meetings amid simmering tensions between Moscow and Tel Aviv. Relations between Russia and Israel have taken a turn for the worse since the beginning of the Russian special military operation in Ukraine. Israel blatantly expressed its opposition to the Russian move, stating that it considers the military action a violation of international law. Moscow, on the other hand, hit back, saying Israel is trying to divert attention from the Palestine-Israel conflict.
Russia, Putin just finally got it enough with Israel's playing around. Russia has a big commitment because there's a lot of Russian Jews in Israel. But at some point, they're not getting their pensions now because of the Western sanctions. And Israel's bombing in Syria constantly, and now you've got it invading Gaza, that it's just, it's beyond the pale. And then Israel turns around and votes against Russia in the UN Human Rights Council, which is just another slap in the face, the horrors that Israel perpetuates all the time and gets away with there. So, yes, this is a moment where Russia is finally going back to its roots, which were after 48, when it played with Israel. It got burnt and it went for a moral position to support the Palestinians. And that's where Russia is returning to now. So it's an exciting moment.
Israel's hawkish stance against Russia may backfire on the regime. For starters, Russia is a UN veto-wielding member, and it can go against Israel. Furthermore, Russia's pro-Hamas stance can spread to other resistance groups, and this could translate into military support, something Israel would vehemently oppose. While Tel Aviv has been able to get away with violating Palestinian rights, now it has to worry about Hamas military action against it, and this may end up being very costly for it. Israel's remarks around the Ukraine conflict, where it slammed Russia, saying its actions are a violation of international law, have sparked anger in Moscow. And this while Russia says Israeli mercenaries are fighting side by side with the Ukrainians against the Russians only worsens the already simmering tensions. Relations between Moscow and Tel Aviv have also soured following Israel's continued airstrikes in Syria, despite criticism from Moscow. But could all this mean that Israel has given up on ties with Moscow and may even be looking for confrontation with Russia?
Israel is already confronting Russia. It was the reason behind a Russian plane being shot down. With Israel playing its tricks in the air. And this is a continual onslaught against Syria, against the Syrian government that Russia is supporting, and Russia is trying to stabilize Syria, get rid of ISIS. Israel is playing games there. It's trying to undermine Russia and Assad. And it's actually supporting ISIS at some points, along with the U.S., with its dirty tricks. So I really think that Russia, it's very much like the situation in Ukraine. Russia, Putin has been very low-key and very restrained in Ukraine. It could have blasted right from the start and killed tens of thousands and forced to surrender. But it didn't, because Ukrainians are almost Russians. And Putin didn't want that. But because of what the U.S. is doing and because of Zelensky, it's turned into a bloodbath. Well, that's exactly the same kind of situation that you see in Syria. And Israel is promoting the bloodbath. So let's hope that Russia finally against Israel, which it should have done a long time ago.
Degrading ties between Moscow and Tel Aviv have, however, sparked fresh hope for the Palestinians to become a powerful member of the international community that can upgrade its resistance against the years-long Israeli oppression, aggression, and blockades. This would also fly in the face of the US side, which has staunchly supported Israel.
We are with you. What about you? IRIB English Radio.